Dawn Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the Free Odyssey app.
Good morning, Marion.
Good morning.
The doctor's in the house.
Wonderful to be on. Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I can hear you now, as we say.
Yeah.
So I love the way that you approach this as, yes, a doctor, but all as a pediatrician, but as well, somebody who's a mom, right? And so you approach this with a very loving, caring, I mean, that's how you're couching this, to think about not just where the dollars are going and not just about providing care for kids, maybe their mental health issues, et cetera, but looking at this through your lens as both somebody who's not only a doctor, but as well a compassionate, loving, you know, mom and doctor. I want you to take me through in your latest piece that you've written, and we'll talk about where people can find it, and I encourage everybody to read it. But you're talking about what you discover as troubling. $6 million on efforts to alter gender appearance of children. And so what do you see here? And what I'm inferring from you is that it's the cause and effect. This is not a tiny percentage of people, whether they're teens or adults, who go in for care. That's not, I'm inferring from your latest piece that you've written, that's not what you're seeing here.
Well, so first of all, Dawn, I didn't write the piece. I simply provided the quote.
Providing the quote,
and
yes.
It is troubling because people are going through databases and finding the amount, you know, the dollar amount that is spent on these cares. And it isn't always about the dollar. I mean, the basic question is, are we doing harm by providing medicines, or are we doing harm by providing irreversible surgeries? And, you know, what are we doing in the future? Having that question doesn't mean that you hate children who believe that they belong in a different appearance of a gender body than the one in which they were born. You know, I have a lot of compassion for any child who is upset, confused, potentially even suicidal. Do you mind if I tell a story of something that happened many years ago to kind
sure.
of compare and contrast? Okay, so, you know, I'm going to take you back years and years. I'm not going to say how many, you know, and I'm not going to use any names here. I was working in an outpatient setting and had a 15, 16, somewhere along that line, girl come in. And, you know, we do a portion of almost every visit where we say, hey, like, if there's anything you need to talk about. So she asked her mother to leave. And after her mother left, she started crying. And she said she was depressed and anxious, and she didn't want to tell her mother. And she was bisexual, and she didn't want to tell her mother that either. Mm-hmm. Now, you also have to picture, like, medicine. This is many years ago. Medicine, I had more time, as did other pediatricians, to take care of the patient. Like now, well checks are down to 20, 30 minutes, and sick visits are down to 7 minutes. It's a mess. But, you know, even back then, you were limited. And, you know, you have a whole cadre of patients that are in. You have to take care of all of them. So I said to this young girl, okay, look, this is a serious issue. You and I are, we're going to talk about this. At some point, I may have to break, go to another patient, but I want you to stay here, and you and I are going to formulate a plan together. And I will not, you know, you're of age where if you want me to keep something confidential, telling your mother won't necessarily happen, but I'd like you to share with your mother. So anyway, I asked her if she thought she could at least share with her mother that she was depressed, and she was crying because she said there's depression in her family. She felt like she was bringing down her mother, and she was disappointing her. And, you know, let's compare and contrast that to now. We have done a lot of work with stigma. So now when people are upset, depressed, anxious, they're talking about it. And that's a good thing. So mother came into the room, and the girl had told me, I don't want to talk about the bisexuality. And I said, okay, I can respect that. Now let's also compare and contrast. Back at that time, I mean, this whole idea, this is years and years ago, this whole idea that, oh, let's take our youth and inject things into their arms, inject a device underneath their skin that releases daily hormones to block the process that their body was born into, that was not going on. And now compare and contrast. And the people who wrote the article, you can see they came up with us spending $6 million in Pennsylvania on these processes, including surgery. But whatever the case, the young girl revealed to her mother that she was depressed. You know, her mother cried, she cried, you know, there's a lot of hugging and there's a lot of conversation going on and there's a lot of togetherness here. And I said to the two of them, I'm going to get you in touch with a psychologist and they will work with a psychiatrist, but you need some help. Now let's compare and contrast. Can you find a psychologist for a child today or a psychiatrist? My phone's going off all the time. You might even be able to hear the buzz, but people are asking me, what should I do? It's months and months to get in. But I found someone for her, and it was still months back then, years and years ago. Mm-hmm. So she got in for care. And in the meantime, I said, look, I'm able to write a prescription. And I personally use medications as a last resort. I mean, you know, Dawn, I'm married to a surgeon. We mm-hmm. each have our own prescribing ability. Our children are all in their 20s, and they've had 5 rounds of antibiotics their whole lives. You know, like, we can write anything we want. We tend not to go there. And we are just, meds are something you do when you need them, but you don't jump to them. And sometimes they are needed. So I'm not anti-pharma. I think we have to have pragmatic approaches all around. So we got this young girl on a dose of antidepressants, and I told her, and I remember looking into her eyes, and I said, if you get worse, if you feel like you want to harm yourself, and I made sure she didn't. And, you know, by the time we were finished that day, she had been with me for an hour and a half mm-hmm. as I'm going back and forth between patients, because we were going to have a plan. But I said, you need another plan. If you ever get to there, you have to tell someone immediately before you hurt yourself, mm-hmm. preferably your mother. Well, 3 weeks later, it was a midnight phone call from her mother, who was crying and said, Dr. Mass, I'm so grateful. We're on our way. We're taking her to the ER. She told us that she was suicidal. And, you know, she had revealed to her mother that she was bisexual. And back then, you know, like, if you mm-hmm. revealed you were bisexual, no one was coming along saying, well, you might really be a boy. They were, okay, you're bisexual. I mm-hmm. didn't do it. And the mother was like, I'm really grateful for what you've done and your warnings. And she got through the care, and then some inpatient was done. And she came back a couple weeks after inpatient. And, you know, we talked about other things she could do. Dawn, you know lots about me right now. By now, you know, I said we talked about good eating habits, good sleeping mm-hmm. habits. We didn't really have screen issues back then. Let's compare and contrast. Now we have the screen issues, and Lord knows what they're pushing people into or pushing people towards. But, you know, we did talk about good eating habits. And, you know, I said, get busy, you know, take a walk, like, think about like some kind of exercise. And this girl was significantly overweight. And, you know, I didn't shame her. We mm-hmm. talked about, you know, these are all common sense things you could do that might help, that they may be hard, but you can do hard things. That's one of the things I say to kids all the time. You can do hard things. She came back, and maybe, like, we kept in touch by phone. She came back for visits, and I remember seeing her maybe 6 months, 8 months, a year. I don't even remember what it was after all of the, you know, this had mm-hmm. transpired. She had lost a significant amount of weight. She had joined an athletic group at school. Mm-hmm. She had a new set of friends. She felt good. She hugged me. She came in and she hugged me. And, you know, so now, like, when I think about that story in its entirety and where we are now, you know,
yes.
now people say, oh, well, maybe parents shouldn't know what their children are up to doing in the schools.
Right.
I mean, back in 2017, the American Academy of Pediatrics was putting out warnings, like, if your child gets a tattoo, you really should be aware because they could get an infection.
Yes.
But we're going to inject with drugs and hormones and,
yes.
maybe life-altering surgery.
And so listen to the difference of you treating a patient. I think it's important to tell that story, that this is compassion, this is loving care. But Beth Ann Rossica, in her latest investigative piece in Broad and Liberty, just posted, talked about in the past, you know, less than 10 years, 9 years, Pennsylvania spending more than $23 million of taxpayers' dollars on these sex reassignment, transition-related services, and drugs for minors. And so part of this is that, and this is my question of what concerns you as a pediatrician. Have you dealt with these issues for years? Yes, but something else is happening here. And is it related to social media? Is it related to a movement? Is it related? Some people say this is pharmaceuticals or greed or money. What do you see and what are your concerns about this? Because in some parts of the country, it's not existing. In other parts like the East Coast and the West Coast, how is it that suddenly we have this explosion of people who want these medications at ages as young as 8 and 9 years old?
Well, how we got to the point where we have the explosion, I mean, there's going to be a lot of factors in there. Do I think social media is a part of it? You know, absolutely. And look, I'm not immune to this either. Mm-hmm. I have children in my 20s. It has been more than once that they have something medical themselves going on. They call up, we'll have a three-way conversation. My husband, the surgeon, me, the pediatrician, and then said child. Well, now they're adults, but they'll say, like, well, don't. And we don't mind because this is how we are with patients. They'll question, you know, are you really sure this is it? Because I read on Google. Can you imagine?
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Like, wait a second. You know, long ago, there was a neck problem in my family. It was a musculoskeletal problem, we believe. And I'm like, okay, listen here. Your father is a head and neck surgeon. I am a pediatrician. This is what you're telling. But it's funny. You know, we probably talk to our children a little bit more familiarly mm-hmm. than we would with patients. But, you know, patients ask all the time about, you know, the Dr. Google kind of stuff.
Yes.
I think a lot of kids, they're connected to those phones. They spend 5-7 hours a day on their phones. Is this what's driving it? And to do another compare and contrast, let's compare and contrast what's going on across the pond in England, mm-hmm. shall we?
Yes. Well, before we get to that, I do want to just introduce another thought. And we've talked before, or I've talked about it, the Do No Harm, and it's a site people can look at, protecting minors from gender, from pushing this gender ideology, right? And they're taking it at the core of the Hippocratic Oath to say, do no harm. But are doctors being trained or instructed that doing no harm means that you prescribe these things, that when a kid says, hey, I want to transition, I want the meds, I want the bottom surgery or the top surgery, is that the new push?
Well, listen, in what I do in medicine, I'm not having to make those decisions, mm-hmm. okay? So many might say, well, just go to the expert. I mean, I have, I've certainly met plastic surgeons who were asked to provide such surgeries and they declined.
Yes.
There's other surgeons who will do those surgeries. You know, like there's the question of, and, you know, I just told you a story in which I related. I was very concerned about a child being suicidal. We certainly hear all the time that we have to perform what is being called gender-affirming care. I will call it medicalization of children who have questions about their gender. But when we say that, you know, these children will commit suicide unless we give them what supposedly right. they want, how do we know that 20 years from now there is not going to be some neurologic side effect from years and years of hormones that were not the hormones meant to be secreted by this body that will put these children at risk of suicide? How do we know mm-hmm. that 10 years from now a young woman who believes she wants her breasts taken off, you know, then changes her mind? I mean,
right. teenagers or kids sterilized. You know,
100%.
And that's the latest report yeah. that says, you know, the latest report, Do Not Harm. I know Broad Liberty's reporting this, other national publications, but locally here at in our area, children's hospitals here, 122 children went through sex change services. Hormone and puberty blocker medications went to 117 children. These prescriptions went to 768 children. I mean, these are big numbers that we're seeing. This is not just a rare thing anymore, and this is increasing. And so just last year, the number that we're being given is over $5 million. And some of this is insurance, some of it's tax dollars, reportedly by these statistics that we're being given. So is this now a push? Is this, are doctors being pushed into this, do you feel, or pediatricians, that you start asking the question, leading the patient?
It, to me, it feels like a push. You know, the American Academy of Pediatrics, they are supposed to be in the midst of a review, a systemic review, just like the Cass report. That's mm-hmm. what the Cass report is. In England, Hilary Cass, who's, this is not a, she's a pediatrician. Mm-hmm. She was a former president of the Royal College of Pediatricians and Child Health from 2012 to 2015. So she's a person of consequence. She spent 4 years looking at a report, and you know, the summary of just such a report is that there was very poor evidence to show that that this type of care was helpful for children. So the evidence does not exist. I believe the report is something like 500 pages.
Yes.
And, you know,
and it's peer reviewed.
Very poor evidence for the safety and efficacy. So to question this, and then there's the American Academy of Pediatrics who, you know, I guess what they've announced is, okay, we're going to do a similar report, but in the meanwhile, we're going, I don't want to quote them because I'm not on their website. I'm not a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics and haven't been since the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. It's a choice, but the general tendency seems to be let's affirm. I mean, they just had their national conference and exhibition. Dr. Levine from Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. former head of health here in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Dr. Levine was born male, transitioned to female as an adult, actually quoted as saying, Dr. Levine has said that they're very happy that they mm-hmm. had their children before they transitioned.
Yeah, Dr. Richard Levine went to Harvard, had a lot of blessings, and then Dr. Richard Levine's life, wife, children, and then much later in life transitioned and now identifies as Rachel Levine. But we've reported on, you know, really more talking about the nursing home issue during COVID. I won't get into that right now. But, you're right. That's somebody who had said, hey, I'm glad I had kids when I identified as a man and a dad. You know, went to Harvard, went to law school, had a practice, right? And then transitioned much later in life.
So we have a scenario in which, like, you know, the whatever we would say, the respected organizations, the powers that be, a push, no one's pushing me and saying you must. And I will tell you, if I meet a child that wants to be called by a name or a pronoun, I comply to the best of my ability. It's hard. Mm-hmm. Someone says I want you to call me they or refer to me as they. It's very difficult for me to do because it defies like the laws of grammar as well.
The pronouns, right?
Right. But I try because,
yes,
like, the person is in front of me and I'm trying to respect, you know, that person.
Yes.
But I do think, just as I told my children very lovingly, I don't want you to have a phone until the end of eighth grade, and then it's not going to be an iPhone. Putting limits on my child was a very loving maneuver for me. You know, to put limits on a child to say, no, I don't think we need hormones injected. And then, you know, I don't think getting your breasts cut off is the right thing. I mean, it also, I'll add, you know, I've said several times, I'm married to a surgeon. When I think of a surgery being done, I think of the surgery from beginning to end. I think of the fact that you're going to have anesthesia. There's mm-hmm. risks to anesthesia. I've seen pictures of the scars after breast removal.
Yeah.
I've seen the staples. You know, you're just taking off two large chunks of fatty tissue. That's a huge risk for infection,
mm-hmm.
you know, let alone, like, you know, the drainage and the infection afterwards, the pain, what have you done with nerves, the fact that it is irreversible. And then we haven't even talked about the bottom surgeries. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you're dealing with tissue. You know, there's patients that discuss the fact that they end up with fistulas, so they end up urinating or stooling out of what vagina was built because of all the breakdown in the tissues. We're performing experiments. If we're doing these experiments on children, and albeit I will say the bottom surgeries, I think, are less frequently done, of course, than hormones and top surgeries, et cetera. But even the hormones, we are talking about blocking the normal round of puberty in a child that did not need puberty blocked. People who agree that this should be done and that there's no side effects will come along and say, well, what about the children with precocious puberty? Well, that exists, I believe, in about 1 in 10,000. So in the Philadelphia region, for females, we should be seeing maybe 10 a year, right? You know, to give you a number, if you break down the number of people that we have here. And does that need to happen? Well, of course it does. But you're blocking the puberty until which time it begins. And, you know, we see puberty starting in some cases as young as age 6, 7, 8. You know, maybe you would want to block if you see it starting at 6, but if you see it starting at 8, maybe you'd say, well, like, this is, we're not going to block this puberty. And so you're blocking it for a short period of time, whereas if you're taking a child that starts puberty at 9 that says that they're transgender, you might be blocking puberty until they're 18. There's no long-term study on that.
So what if... Because let me just ask you something, Dr. Maz. Because we're seeing this at our local hospitals, we're seeing it across the country, nationwide. The numbers are staggering. This is it's not a rare thing anymore. And so, what if a doctor at one of these hospitals says, "Let's slow this down. Is there a culture that's within hospitals and with medical offices where the pressure is on the physicians to say, oh, no, you've got to prescribe this, or you've got to really talk to them about their different options. And this is a kid who's, especially a kid under, let's say, 16. You know, some of these kids are young. Is that going on?
Well, all right. So,
like a peer pressure.
I'm trying to be very careful because cannot speak for my employer, and I will not. I don't. I work in a big tent operation, right? And I guess what I would say is let's back up the conversation a little bit, and I'll give you another example of way back then and now. You know, I was a child. I remember taking St. Joseph's baby aspirin. I can still see the little bottle with a soldier on it. And then sometime in the 70s, we discovered that children are not little adults. And if you give children aspirin when they have fevers and they happen to have flu, they might get something horrible called Reye syndrome. Mm-hmm. Their liver shuts down and they end up in intensive care units. So we stopped giving children aspirin. So we're talking about aspirin. Think about how often an adult uses an aspirin. Yeah. Well, it might not be so good for kids, but someone had to come along and discover this and point this out and say something. Should the person who came along and said, don't give aspirin, it's bad for children, be questioned, and should they be considered hateful because, oh, wow, you must hate the physicians that have given aspirin? No, we find things out. We discover things. I'm not in a position where I would be asked to give hormones or even refer. That's not my role in the world of pediatrics. I have talked to pediatricians around the country. I published a piece in Fox News a year ago with another pediatrician from Ohio, a dear friend, Dr. Nikki Johnson. I think we reviewed what we knew, and we were writing about the American Academy of Pediatrics announcing that they were going to look at the evidence. And we had some opinions in there. I had a lot of pediatricians around the country across the aisle reach out to me and said, I read this. Thank you. Someone needs to say it. Mm-hmm. What I inferred from that, and I even had people saying to me, you're brave for saying this.
Yes.
I was brave for saying what? That we should consider that we might be causing harm by giving years and years followed by decades and decades of hormones, or by questioning whether or not surgery should be done. You're afraid to ask if that's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we, as women, you know, there's the question, Dr. Marty McCary, I've met him several times. He's brilliant, from Johns Hopkins.
Yes.
His book, terrific book, Blind Spots, you know, it's number one on the bestseller list. Go, Dr. McCary, go. But in his book, and I haven't gotten through all of it. My husband stole my he stole my Kindle. He's like, he bought me the Kindle. I had to segue. He bought me the Kindle. And he's like, you know, it was my birthday present. And then he comes along and he's like, I think I'm going to download a book. I'd like to see what it's like to read on the Kindle. Dawn, he downloaded War and Peace.
Oh,
my Kindle has been appropriated.
Of all books.
But in any case, Dr. McCary talked about the fact that women, you know, we used to question whether or not they should do hormone replacement therapy.
Yeah.
And it was very poor evidence. Thank God people came along and questioned it. You know, have you been through menopause? I have. It's really ugly. I thought it was worse than puberty, but I mean, puberty was a long time ago. I thought menopause was terrible. I actually passed out during a hot flash, whacked my head, got four staples and stitches in my face. You know, they put me on HRT for a couple years, and it sort of, you know, so I was on a medication for a few years. And, you know, now I feel like, okay, well, I'm glad that I'm not passing out, or I wasn't passing out and having more stitches and staples. But, you know, for a long time, no to HRT. And now people are beginning to question the evidence. We should be questioning. We should have done this all through COVID.
Yes.
Why did everyone run to remdesivir? Why are they running to Paxlovid? You know, instead of having an angry response, I mean, if you disagree with another physician, who cares? We do it all the time. We do it in my house. There's two of us here.
Yeah.
We disagree on things and we have a discussion and we don't call one another hateful. You know, it's, wow. Sorry, I think we got off topic with War and Peace and the Kindle.
No, I think it's important. You know, we've let this interview breathe a little bit because the truth is it's important that we're approaching this out of a place of love, care, compassion, but also looking at the facts and figuring out whether or not there is a push, or is it politics, or is there another agenda? I think that's a fair question, given, like you said, the CAS review, which I've talked about. I've interviewed Dr. Marty McCary about his book, Blind Spots, When Medicine Gets It Wrong. It's important, too, that, you know, that we have the conversation, because people listen to that and they say, okay, that gives me permission to ask the questions, too, or to say to my kid, you know what, let's go get a second opinion. And I think that's a piece of this. I want to keep the conversation going. But Dr. Mary Mass, we keep saying we're going to talk about empty nesters. I swear we will get to it. But we just love you and appreciate all your time. Thank you so much.
Oh, come on. Anytime, Dawn. I'm having a great empty nest time. So, yes, let's make that a date sometime. It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's pleasure's all mine.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.